I very much appreciate that which has gone before. I do ask that you pray for us, time we stand before you. I'd like to go back this evening to the book of Revelation and carry on with the sixth church of Asia, which is found in Revelation chapter 3. It's the church of Philadelphia. At the outset of this series, we mentioned that of the seven churches, five of them had problems that would be addressed particularly by Christ through His servant John. But two of these churches, although we realize that all churches are imperfect and they are made of weak and imperfect people, there were two churches that did not have any problem addressed. Doesn't mean that they didn't have any problem that ever came up, but nothing was going on in the church worthy of a rebuke or worthy of a correction or anything like that. We talked about one of them already in the church at Smyrna. And the church at Philadelphia is another church in this particular passage where, as long as I've been reading through this passage, I have never found where they had anything brought to their attention that they were doing wrong. Go with me to Revelation chapter 3, starting in verse 7. Revelation 3 and 7. "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, These things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and shutteth, and no man openeth. I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I will also keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches." As long as I've been reading, I find nothing in that passage that strikes of anything they're doing wrong. But you know, even if we're doing the right things, even if we're going in the right way, we still need encouragement. The Bible is for our encouragement in many different ways. Paul tells Timothy that there's four areas that the Scripture is profitable for. One of them is doctrine. One of them is reproof. One of them is correction. And the other one is instruction in righteousness. And even if we don't stand in need of reproof or correction, we all stand in need of instruction in righteousness. That even if we're not doing poorly, we need to be encouraged so that when times of trial come, we stand up to those trials in an honorable and admirable way. Last Sunday night, we talked about the church in Sardis, which was what you might think of as a dying church. And the address there was to encourage a church that seemed like she was dying. This address is to a church that is doing rather well, and it's an encouragement to a church that is doing well. Now, there are a lot of definitions to these churches' names, most of which I have passed from because, unlike some things in Scripture, some names I've just not found any significance for. Now, I'm not saying they're not there, I just hadn't found them. But friends, this church has a name that I think is very significant. The word Philadelphia means brotherly love. Now, what could be more fitting for a church that is doing very well than to be called brotherly love? Paul tells us in Hebrews 13:1, he says, "Let brotherly love continue." And when you look at this church, she is a church that is, I would like to say, I don't know how the best way to say this, she is more than an institution. You know, the church is an institution. She is an organization that Christ has set up in this world. But she's more than that. She is also set up as a family. When you look at the church, you're not just looking at a body of people like you would look at out in the world that is an organized group of people set to do some certain thing. When you look at the Lions Club, all those lions are a body of people set to do one particular thing, whatever that is. I'm not a lion, but whatever it is that they do, that's what they're there for. But friends, when the Lions Club meets, they don't exactly look at themselves as family. They're just a club meeting together. Friends, the Lord's church ain't a club. It's not some civil function or organization. The Lord's church is an organization, but she's also a family. A family of people who ought to look at one another in a sense of love and affection, the way brothers and family have one to another. This church is a church of brotherly love. Now let's look at this church a little bit, because friends, this is a great encouragement to me to read about this church in a dark world, knowing that we, as the church of God today, have the ability to exist likewise as a church of love in a dark world. He says, "These things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth and no man openeth." Again, he is starting this address talking about Christ and some things about Christ. The one thing in this description of Christ that I'd like to point out is that he has the key of David. Notice how that ties into verse 8. In verse 8, he says, "I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it, for thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name." One of the reasons why the church is so special is because he that owns the church is he that hath the key of David. Now, when you have the key of David, as Christ does, if you open, it's open. If you shut, it's shut. And he says here, "I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it." You know, whenever you talk about the church, a lot of times people wonder what it is about the church that makes it so special. What is it about this place that makes us want to come back over and over and over again? Well, friends, if there is a church of brotherly love, if there is a church like Philadelphia that has the very presence of God showered down upon it time after time after time, he sets before that church an open door that man cannot shut. Paul prayed in Colossians chapter 4. In Colossians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, Paul encouraged the church this way. He says, "Continue in prayer and watch in the same with thanksgiving." Now, what is it we come praying for? What is it we come watching for with thanksgiving? Paul says that unto us a door of utterance might be given, that we might be able to make manifest the Word of God even as we ought to speak. Friends, we come here because the Lord who owns the church, Jesus Christ, has a key. And when He opens the door, a door of utterance comes down out of heaven that man can't shut. Friends, whenever God blesses us with His presence and His Spirit-felt guidance, man cannot stop that power when it comes. Now, man might ignore it, man might deny it, but when God has purposed to bless His Spirit to come down, friends, a door of utterance goes forth that makes this a glorious place. It sets it apart from any institution of man, and it makes me want to come back over and over and over again. He says, "I know thy works. I know thy patience." And friends, if you want the door to be open, it's going to take some work and it's going to take some patience, because sometimes, we're not nearly as patient as we ought to be. I'll tell you, whenever I'm studying, whenever I'm praying, and whenever I'm trying to think about what it is I'm going to preach about, you know, I'm an impatient person. I'll just admit it. Monday comes and I don't have a subject, I'm going to say, "Well, it better come." Tuesday comes, I don't have a subject, "Well, I wonder what the Lord's waiting for." Wednesday comes, there's no subject. If I go to Pleasant Plains on Wednesday night and I get called on, I'm in trouble. Thursday, no subject. Friday, no subject. Saturday comes and I don't have a subject, I start panicking. I don't know about Brother Gary, but I start panicking if Saturday night comes and I don't have anything to preach. I really start panicking if Sunday morning comes and I still don't have anything. Friends, sometimes it takes patience to wait upon the Lord. But when that door of utterance is open, when that door of thanksgiving, when that door of praise comes open from heaven, the Lord blesses us with His presence. Now notice what He says. He says, "No man can shut it." You know, man's been trying to shut the doors on the church ever since the Lord put the church in this world. The world has been trying, Satan and all of his forces have been trying ever since the church was put in this world to close it up for good. But notice what he says in the next verse. He says this in verse 9. He says, "Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee." You know, I find it interesting that the same expression shows up here that also showed up in Smyrna. Smyrna was the other church that had no problems that were addressed. When the Lord is speaking to Smyrna, you know who he talks about? He talks about the synagogue of Satan. When he starts talking to the church at Philadelphia, you know who he starts talking about? He starts talking about the synagogue of Satan. Now, why is it that the synagogue of Satan would come up both times the Lord is talking to a church that is doing well? Because, friends, the devil works the hardest at those that are doing the best. The devil is going to work overtime at those who are doing well. He's going to spend a very little amount of energy on those that are not doing very well, and he's going to spend a lot of energy on those that are doing really well. You can always rest assured that the better you're doing and the harder you're trying, the harder Satan's trying to overthrow what you're trying to do. It's always the same. If you try to do really well, the devil steps up the attack. If you try to live a godly life, the devil will step up his arsenal of darts to throw at you. And I'll tell you this, I don't like giving compliments to the devil. I really hate doing it, but there's one compliment I can give him. He ain't lazy. He doesn't give up. And rest assured, if you try to live right for the rest of your life, he'll be right there with you, trying to get you to do wrong for the rest of your life. Whenever a church is doing well, rest assured the synagogue of Satan will step up its attack to try to make that church not do well. But here's what he says. He says, I know those that are of the synagogue of Satan. I know their works. I know they say they're Jews, and I know they're liars. He says, I know that sometimes they go about maybe even saying they're doing this in God's name. You know, Saul of Tarsus, when he persecuted the church, you know whose name he said he was doing it in? God's name. He was zealous over the tradition of his fathers. He said he was following after the same religion that his fathers followed after. He wasn't doing God's will, and he wasn't doing God's service. And folks, there's a lot of people today who aren't doing God's will and aren't doing God's service. There is an expression, I think we mentioned it last Sunday night, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, when Paul talks about this, know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. He lists 19 things that are indications of the last times. About men being lovers of their own selves. About men being hateful and proud. Children being disobedient to parents. All the things that we see today. The 19th thing on that list is having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. That means they use religion as a tool to fuel their own pleasure, to fuel their own desire and their own gain in this world. Now, I'm not going to call any names tonight because that's not profitable. But friends, if we're ever using religion to fuel our own desires and our own gains, we're having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Friends, I don't come here to fuel my own gain. I don't come here to fuel my own pleasure. We ought to be here to serve and uplift the glorious name of Jesus Christ. They say they're Jews. They may even say they're doing my service. I know they're liars, but here's what I'm going to do to them. He says, they may say they're Jews, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Now we, as we were talking about the church in Thyatira, there is some interesting language there that we'll go back and look at. He says that those of the synagogue of Satan, he'll make them come and worship at their feet. Notice how he finishes the address to Thyatira. Just to refresh our memory, at the end of Revelation 2, he says, and this is Revelation 2, verse 26. He says, and he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I have received of my Father, and I will give him the morning star. He tells the church in Thyatira, he said, if you overcome, I'll bless you to rule over nations. I'll bless you to, as a potter, break them to shivers with a rod of iron. Here he says, I'll bless you that those that are liars, those that are of the synagogue of Satan, they'll come and worship at your feet. Now you say, well, does that mean the church is going to play an important part in the politics of this world? No, sir. Does it mean that the church is going to be the most sought-after institution in this world? No, sir. But there is something this church has. There is something that the Lord's church in this world has that nobody else has. Go with me to Psalm 48. In Psalm 48, we read about what the church has. Things that men want, that men will never have, and when men see that the church has it, they become very afraid. Psalm 48. Psalmist starts talking about the church. Psalm 48:1, he says, great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness. Beautiful for situation, The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king. God is known in her palaces for a refuge. For, lo, the kings were assembled. They passed by it together. They saw it and they marveled. They were troubled and hasted away. Fear took hold upon them there, and pain as of a woman in travail. Here he's talking about Mount Zion. We're told that Mount Zion is a picture of the Lord's church in Hebrews 12. So he's talking about the church. He's talking about Mount Zion. He's talking about Philadelphia. I hope and trust he's talking about Cool Springs. He's talking about places where his name has been set, where people come to honor and to worship him. And what does he say about this mountain? He says it's the joy of what? The whole earth. Now, friends, there are a lot of people in this earth that will never joy and honor in the Lord's church, but the psalmist says it's the joy of the whole earth. How is that? You know what happens when man desires to have an empire? He desires to conquer what? The world. You know how far Alexander stretched his empire? That's Alexander the Dead, by the way, that the world thinks of as great, who ruled over Greece many thousands of years ago. When Alexander, this young hothead who died when he was 34 in a drunken stupor, really great life, when he went out and expanded his empire, it says that when he saw that there were no more worlds to conquer, he wept. You know why he wept? Because there was nowhere else to go. He thought, I've got it all. You know, history tells us Alexander didn't get it all. He just got all he knew to get. When Rome came along, Rome got more than Alexander ever did. By the time the British Empire came, the British Empire had that motto that the sun never sets on the British flag. They had so many places that they controlled that somewhere, everywhere, when the sun was up, it was hitting a British flag. That's how big their empire was. They wanted to rule the world. Every empire wants to rule the world. But friends, the Lord's church succeeds where the empires of men fail. The reason it succeeds where the empires of men fail is because the empires of men are known by boundaries. They're known by their governments and the boundaries that they contain. They're known by the rule of conquest that they go forth conquering. Friends, the Lord's church knows no boundaries. It's not a boundary of a nation. It's not a boundary of a culture. It's not a boundary of a race of people. The Lord's church is limitless in this earth. She's been in places that man has not been. She's been felt in the hearts of men where empires haven't even wanted to go forth. You know what empires don't care about? Empires don't care about little backwoods places like Danville, Georgia. They care about places where influence is. But friends, the Lord's church is felt in places where the poor, humble people of this world joy in the presence of the Lord. And friends, there is contentment to be found in the house of God. You know what empires of men never have? They never have contentment. They never have enough. They never conquer enough. They are never satisfied enough. Friends, have you ever felt to just have enough in the house of God? If you have, you have something that the empires of men have never had. Have you ever felt peace and contentment in this world? If you have, you have something the empires of men have never had. And friends, when the empires of men see people at peace and people content, people that the more they persecute, the stronger they get. You ever notice that in the times of persecution, the church seems to get stronger? You know why? Because persecution takes away all those things that we hold most dear that we finally realize don't mean a thing. Friends, if your bank account dissolves tomorrow, if your house gets foreclosed on tomorrow, and God forbid if this country should be bombed almost off this earth, but we're still here, friends, if we have the Lord in His church, we're doing all right. I'm not going to say we're going to be happy, but we'll be doing all right. You know why? Because the Lord has not forsaken us here in this world. Maybe man will throw us into prison. Maybe man will try to take away our rights and our freedoms that we have here in this world. But friends, history records that the Lord's church always seems to do the best when she's persecuted the hardest. Is it any wonder why she's doing so poorly generally across the world when we're doing so well naturally? When you're doing well naturally, you don't feel like you need the Lord as much. Friends, whether well or poor, we need the Lord. And I'll assure you of this. If a natural king or a natural empire looks into the faces of God's people and sees that they can't steal the joy that they have, that the Lord has set before them an open door that those men can't shut, that they see heaven opened. You know, when they stoned Stephen to death, there was a door open that day that they couldn't shut. He looked up and he saw the heavens open. And he saw Jesus, the Son of God, standing at the right hand of God. No matter how many rocks they cast, they couldn't take that away from Him. No matter how much they tried, they couldn't steal that sight that He saw. And friends, if we are holding fast His name, if we have patience in our works, the Lord will give us a peace and a door of joy that no man can take from us, no matter how hard they try. You know what scares a man more than anything else? When he comes up against something that he cannot break, that he cannot make falter. These kings pass by. The kings of the earth, they pass by and they look at Mount Zion and they marvel. But they didn't stop at just marveling. They also got afraid. They got afraid because they saw this was something they couldn't contain. You know, the Lord has His people and His church set in such a way that you just can't contain it. You know, if they burn this building down, they haven't contained the church. If they kill me, they haven't contained the church. You can do without me. Friends, you can do without me a whole lot better than I can do without you. They cannot contain the church. I recall recorded in history where they would burn the Lord's faithful at the stake. You know why they quit burning them at the stake? Because every time they'd burn a saint at the stake, and that saint would sit there burning and singing hymns of praise, begging forgiveness for their tormentors before Almighty God, more people were converted there at the fire than they were in the houses of worship. They had to quit because more people got converted. They said, if that person can go through death, that convicted of their way of life, I'll join up. I want what they have. Friends, sometimes when men try to persecute the church, they end up doing themselves more harm. They see this city, they see Mount Zion, and they get afraid and they haste away. Fear comes upon them as a woman in travail. You know, back in the old days, we talked some this morning about the old days when language was a little bit more fitting than it is now. You know, there was a certain word, even when I was a little boy, and I'm not old, so maybe it's not old day language, but it's older day language. There was a word that I was not allowed to say when I was a little boy. Now, I'm going to say it now just for the sake of information, but when I was a little boy, I was not allowed to use the word pregnant. You remember those days? It was a word that you just didn't say. If you wanted to talk about a woman who was with child, what did you say? You said she was expecting. You know what that is? That's a better description of the situation. You know why? Because fear comes upon them as a woman in travail. You know what happens when a woman is expecting? She's expecting something to happen, and when it comes, it cannot be stopped. Whenever that time comes, I assure you, I was there. I didn't feel the pain. I didn't really have much to do except hold her hand as she squeezed it right off my wrist. But friends, when the day comes, when the child basically says, "Here I come," that's it. What you've been expecting, what you've been waiting for has arrived, and you can't stop it. And friends, no matter how hard man may try, there is something about the Lord's church that we should expect. You know what it is? It will continue on. It will never fail in this earth. And when man sees that, he's afraid. We're told in 1 Thessalonians 5 and 3 that when they shall say, "Peace and safety," then sudden destruction shall come upon them as a woman in travail, and they shall not escape. Friends, when that travail comes, there is no escape. I know man's got ways that he can slow it down, but when it comes, there's no escape. You're going to the hospital, you're having a baby at home. That's about all there is to it. And friends, when the Lord has set His church in this earth and said she will not fail, whether here or somewhere else, it will be here in this earth and no man shall escape. The Lord's presence will be here in His churches, world without end. So, He says, they of the synagogue of Satan, they're going to worship at your feet. Why is that? Well, friends, let me ask you a question. Is Greece as an empire still here? Is Rome as an empire still here? Is the British Empire still here? One day, will these old United States of America still be here? I hope they'll be here in my lifetime, but friends, countries fail. Empires fail. Rome was the empire in power when the Lord set His church in this earth. She's gone. The church is still here. She was replaced by the Ottomans and the Huns and the Turks and the British and all these people going through Europe. Those all have failed. The church is still here. Friends, those empires worship at the feet of the Lord's church. You know why? They failed. She survives. And friends, no matter how many more empires come and no matter how many empires fall, rest assured, whatever is here when the Lord's come back, the church will be an organization and a body of people that will still be here. No matter how great an empire is, the church is superior, bar none. And I'll tell you this, our faith and trust and hope and confidence in the Lord better be here in His church, not in some institution of man or in some nation of man, because this is what will survive. This is what will endure. This is where the Lord's glory will be, no matter what the flag is bearing the national colors. They will worship at the feet of the Lord's church. But that's not to say it won't be without some pain. That's not to say it won't be without some sacrifice. Go back to Revelation 3. In Revelation 3, He says, they're going to worship at Thy feet and know that I have loved Thee. He says, because Thou hast kept the word of My patience, I will also keep Thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. Here He says, because thou hast kept the word of My patience, I will also keep thee from the hour of temptation. Now, I do believe that the hour of temptation that He's talking about is the hour that comes in Revelation 20. But before anybody thinks that I'm preaching a works-based salvation, please hear me out. Whenever He says, because thou hast kept My works, He says, I'll keep thee from the hour of temptation. Now, He's not saying, because you've done this, I will do this. He's saying, because you have done this, you have known that I will do this. Friends, there are people in this world that when they die, do not have the peace and the assurance that they're going to see the Lord's face in righteousness. You know why? Some of them may not even know a lot about the Lord's Word. Now, they know the Lord, but they don't know a lot about Him. If you're talking to somebody who lost a loved one, their loved one had passed away, and they just came to the funeral like all was gone, all hope was lost, this is it, they shed tears like there was no tomorrow, but you knew they were good people. Friends, they're sorrowing like someone who has no hope. And we can be like that. We can sorrow like someone who has no hope. But friends, if we keep the word of His patience, if we walk circumspectly in this world, we don't have to worry about dying in fear of what's going to happen. Whenever you come to the Lord's house faithfully, whenever you read your Bible faithfully, whenever you unite with the Lord's church and walk as a member of His body openly in this world, you don't have to worry about dying wondering what's going to happen. Because friends, the Lord's better than that. The Lord told David, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. Friends, if you live faithful to the Lord, I'll tell you, He's going to be with you regardless. But how would you like to go through death wondering what your fate's going to be, or go through death waiting to see His face in righteousness? Either way, you're going to see His face in righteousness, but I'd rather go through it expecting to see it, wouldn't you? He says, you've kept My word, therefore you don't have to worry about the hour of temptation. Now I realize there's some hours of temptation, there's some hours of trial that come upon us here in this world. And friends, I'll tell you this, no matter how bad the trials of this world get, no matter how bad the sufferings of this world get, I want to tell you this, they pale in comparison to the joy that we're going to have in heaven. Notice what He said, I'm going to keep you from the hour of temptation. Now He's not going to take away all of our burdens and take away all of our trials, but notice how He follows that up. He says, behold, I come quickly. You say, well, He could say that in John's day because He hadn't been gone very long. But preacher, it's been 2,000 years and He's still not here. Friends, in the Lord's sight, it's but as yesterday. In the Lord's sight, it's but as yesterday when His Son went back to glory. He says in 2 Peter 3:8, He says, 1,000 years is as 1 day and 1 day is 1,000 years in the Lord's sight. Don't ever think, because this world has gone on some 2,000 years since Christ went back to glory, that somehow the Lord's forgotten about us. He hasn't. Don't think that because so much time has passed and so many people have lived and died, that somehow the Lord has forgotten about us. Friends, if you go through a trial, if you go through an hour of temptation tomorrow or the next day or next month or next year. And let's say that trial and that temptation lasts day after day after day after day. And you say, where's the Lord? Friends, remember this. 40 days of temptation may seem like a lifetime. But 40 days in the sight of the Lord is like that. It's like nothing. When I consider my life, James says, what is our life? It is even as a vapor, which appears for a short time and then it passeth away. Friends, if I live to be an old man, which, as I mentioned before, in our family tree is not that old. But friends, let's say I live to be 100 years old. Let's say the Lord blessed me to live like people before the flood and I live 900 and something years. And let's say of those 900 and something years, that I experience pain and heartache and suffering all 900 and something years. Friends, He still comes quickly. And all those years of my suffering and all those years of my pain, they're but a drop of a bucket in His sight. And friends, no matter how hard the situation in life might be, remember this, in the sight of God, He's coming quickly. I don't know if it's tomorrow or the next day or next month or next year, but friends, in His sight, it's quick. He's coming. Don't ever think that His hand is going to be slack or short considering that promise. When the hour has come, He's coming. In His sight, it's quickly. And it's always better if we think of things from His perspective and not from ours. In His perspective, our lifespan is very short. In our lifespan, His coming is very quick. Friends, no matter how bad the temptation gets, always remember this. Our light affliction is but for a moment. Why is it but for a moment? Because in the sight of eternity, it pales in comparison. Behold, I come quickly. And when I come quickly, He says, let no man deceive thee, that he take thy crown from thee, or that no man take thy crown. He says, hold fast that which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. Friends, He's coming. But I want to look forward to that. And my crown, my joy, is the anticipation of it. I don't have to worry about anybody taking my home in heaven. But I do stand in jeopardy of losing my joy of it here in this world. And I don't want that taken from me. Now notice verse 12. As John gets into the end of this address, he goes into the same kind of language that he's been in so many times. He says, him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God. And he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God. And I will write upon him my new name. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Friends, this last piece that John goes through, to me is just the icing on a cake of an encouragement of a church who's doing very well. You know, if you talk about instruction in righteousness, as I've heard it said before, doctrine is that which is right. Reproof is that which is not right. Correction is how to get back to what is right. And instruction in righteousness is how to stay right. We know the more right you stay, the deeper into something you go. You know, I've made a mockery of hammering nails for a long time. I say that because I hammer at nails. It generally starts okay, but eventually I get off and it gets crooked and it ends up bad. That's why I don't work as a carpenter for a living. I'd starve to death trying to nail nails into a board and try to cut boards straight. I almost failed kindergarten because I couldn't cut straight on the line or color within the lines. I guess I don't have it in me. But you know, if you start nailing something straight, you know, whenever I got off nailing something, you know it wasn't at the end. It was always towards the beginning. The further in you go, the deeper and richer the blessings become. The further in the Lord's service you go, the deeper the enjoyment becomes. Friends, I enjoy the Lord's church way more now than I did 21 years ago when I joined. Now, I didn't think it could get any better than the day I was baptized, but it has. Now, there's been some rough moments in between, but friends, it's gotten better. I can't say that I started on a high point. It's all been downhill. Now, there's been some downhill slopes, but friends, I feel better about the Lord's church now than I did 21 years ago. I hope if I live 21 more years, I'll feel a lot better than I do now. Because the deeper you go into the Lord's service, the further you go in instruction and righteousness and trying to stay in that right way, the richer the blessings become. Notice what he says. This is a church that is doing well. He's given them all this encouragement, and this is how he finishes. If you overcome the trials and the temptations that come, here's what you can expect my presence to be with you. To him that overcometh, will I make a pillar in the temple of my God. And he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. Now, friends, your names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. They've been written there since before the foundation of the world. You're engraven in the palms of the Lord's hands. But here he says, I will write upon thee a new name. What name is that that he writes upon him? I believe it's the same name that he wrote upon Abraham. Because, friends, when Abraham overcame the trials and the temptations and the sufferings that he had in this world, he became known as something. We read in James chapter 2, in verses 22 and 23, that our father Abraham, and I don't mind saying he was our father, I realize we're not Jews by nature, but Paul tells us in Romans 4 that if we believe, Abraham is the father of us all. He's the father of the faithful who try to go after God in a way of belief. But in James 2 and 22 and 23, James is talking about how faith, if it doesn't have works, it's dead, being alone. It means it doesn't have any profit. But he says if faith is mixed with works, like Abraham's was, great things happen. He says, ye see then how that our father Abraham, how he was justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac upon the altar. Abraham put his faith in motion in the form of works, and he went up on the mountain. He was ready to slay his son. He was ready to do exactly what God told him to do. And because he was faithful to God in this way, what was he called? James says that he was called the friend of God. Friends, there's a big difference between being a family member and being a friend. You know, I got a lot of family members that I'm stuck with. Allow me to say this, sometimes there ain't a lot of brotherly love when we get together. No charge for that. Maybe you don't have a weird family, but I do. I've got family members that I'd like to disown if I could. Don't tell them I said that, but there's some, I didn't name any names, but there's some I just would rather say I'm just not related to them. I'd just rather say I don't know who you are. But friends, whenever we talk about a friend, we're talking about someone that has a conscious decision and choice to claim that person. You know, I don't just call every acquaintance of mine a friend. I don't tell everybody that I've ever met, you're my friend. There's some I would rather not call them my friend. Why is it that you call somebody your friend? Because, dear ones, there is something about a friend that is deeper than family. Family is someone you're related to. And you hope that in your family, you share things in common with. You don't always, but you hope you do. But what is it about a friend? Solomon tells us in Proverbs 16, and about verse 33, I believe, he says that a man that hath friends must show himself friendly. And he says, and there is a friend which sticketh closer than a brother. You know, a brother, he's got to sort of stick with you. I mean, he's got your back. He sort of has to. He's your brother. But if you have a friend can stick with you closer than a brother. You know why? Because if he claims you as his friend, he's willing to go with you because of his deep desire and his commitment to you. Friends, Abraham's works didn't prove to God that he was a child of God. But his works, mixing with his faith that he had in his heart, proved that he was the friend of God and was called that by those who saw him. Why was he called the friend of God? Because he wanted to stick with God through thick and thin. He wanted to be with God and do whatever God said, no matter how bad his life got. Friends, I've never been asked to kill one of my children. I hope and trust that I never have to put my family's welfare above my service to God. But friends, if someone says, take back everything you've ever said, you've ever preached, we'll put your family in prison. Friends, he means more than my family. His cause means more than my family. It means more than my life. Friends, no matter how bad things get, stick with God. Be with him through thick and thin. Be called a friend of God. To do that, you've got to overcome. Him that overcometh will I give the name of my God. Friends, we're his children. We're his relations.
We will not be disowned, as we talked about yesterday morning. But friends, I'm going to be called His friend here in this world. One who sticks with Him, and that His presence sticks with me. Friends, someone who God blesses His steps to show forth the glory and the honor of God. And how does He do that? How does He show His friendship to us? How does He show that if we are committed to overcoming in this life and sticking close to God, that He sticks close to us? You know, one of the things that God had with Abraham, that I don't find Scripture records that He had with any other man during that time. He talked to Abraham face to face. Maybe not face to face, but God appeared to him in various ways. God sent angels to talk to him. Where else in the time span of Abraham do you find God interacting with a man like that? You don't. Friends, here in the church of God, you can expect to find that when we're faithful and we have patience and we overcome, that God will interact with us unlike He does with people out in the world. Now, He has ways of communicating with His people in the world. Sometimes it's through chastisement, sometimes it's through judgment. But friends, He will interact with us here in a different way. And how does He do it? If we're called His friends, if He writes upon us the name of my God, He says, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. Here we find a reference to a city that John names New Jerusalem. But we're not left in the dark about what New Jerusalem is. John will go on later in this book to talk about this city in some detail. Now, we will not be able to go through the entire description of this city. Please go with me to Revelation 21, and we'll just look at the first four verses. Please go read Revelation 21 and even into 22. There's a lot that's being talked about, but there's two things particularly that are being talked about. In Revelation 21, starting in verse 1, it says, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no death, neither sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. Now, you could ask a dozen preachers what they think about Revelation 21 and 22, and you might get a dozen different answers. Since you're listening to me, you're going to get what I think. If you want to know what Brother Gary thinks, you can ask him when service is over. I hope he thinks something close to what I think. We've never talked about this. But anyway, whenever you talk about the new heaven and the new earth, people have ideas of what that's talking about. Whenever you talk about New Jerusalem, people have ideas of what that's talking about. And for the longest time, I read through these verses, and I was just confused. I was just perplexed. I didn't know what anything was talking about. And finally, one day, I read verse 4 very, very, very slowly. And I finally realized that the reason why I couldn't figure out what things were talking about is because in some sense, I thought every preacher was right. And in some sense, every preacher was wrong. And that's a dangerous combination. But in verse 4, notice the contrast. He says, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And then he says, and there shall be no more crying, neither death, nor sorrow, nor pain anymore. Now, which is it? Do we have no more tears? Or is God wiping away our tears? What I finally tried to realize, and I hope the Lord has blessed me with this, is that John is describing two things. He's describing what he calls a new heaven and a new earth, and he's describing the holy city, New Jerusalem. And the reason I was having such a hard time framing this or understanding what it is that John was talking about is because sometimes when you read the Bible, you're reading it like you're watching Christ walk. You read it like you're watching Christ do these things. I read it like I'm watching those children of Israel go through the Red Sea. I read it like I'm watching David kill Goliath. But to see this sight as it really ought to be seen, I can't stand there and look at John looking at it. I've got to try to stand where John stood and look where he looked. John is standing, the chapter goes on to tell us, in a mountain. And in this mountain, he looks up and he sees a new heaven and a new earth. I believe he saw the very windows of heaven open, and he saw the beautiful paradise of God. He saw the glory of God. He said there was no more sea. All the former things were passed away. All he saw was that heavenly portal of peace, rest, and joy. But then he says he saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, doing what? Coming out of heaven. Goes on later to tell us she is prepared or adorned as a bride for her husband. And this city comes and the tabernacle of God dwells with men. One of the reasons why this chapter is so hard to understand, I believe, is because we can't figure out if you're talking about the New Jerusalem or the New Heaven and the New Earth. Let me just be plain and go on record for what I think. The New Heaven and the New Earth is heaven itself. The Holy City, New Jerusalem, is the Church of God here in this world. And friends, it comes out of heaven as a bride prepared and adorned for her husband. Friends, when we're called the friend of God, what does He write upon us with? Not just a new name, but He blesses us with the name of the city, New Jerusalem, the holy city of my God. Friends, whenever we stick close to God, whenever we overcome all the trials and the temptations of this life, I'm not going to tell you you're not going to have any more sorrow. I'm not going to tell you you're not going to have any more pain. I'm not going to tell you you're not going to have any more tears. Friends, that's reserved for heaven itself. But friends, when God comes down, when the city comes down, and we're blessed with His glory and His presence, He wipes those tears from our eyes, and He whispers sweet peace in our ears, and says, "Peace, be still. I have loved thee. I have not forsaken thee." Friends, when I come to the house of God, sometimes my heart is broken. Sometimes I feel so weighed down from the world. But friends, He takes those tears and He wipes them from my eyes. And He blesses me with sweet peace and comfort. But friends, I don't experience that unless I overcome and I make it here and search for His face. Friends, if you overcome, if you're called the friend of God, if you stand faithful, even in the face of death, friends, He is not unjust. He blesses us with His presence here. He blesses heaven to be opened and the very drippings and the extension of heaven to come down and tabernacle with us. Why is the church so great? Why is she so glorious? Why is it that all the affairs of man pale in her comparison? Because friends, one moment or day in His courts with one glimpse of His face beats all the joy and all the riches and all the pleasures of this world. Friends, if we want to experience the Lord's presence in this way, in this very most special of ways, it takes effort. We've got to have brotherly love. We've got to look at one another as family. Now, I'll say this. We're very blessed here in this church that so many of you are family. That means that even when you're upset with each other, you still have to love each other. But friends, let us, whether family or not, love one another for Christ's sake. Let us, whether we're related or not, and I can say that include me because I'm not related to anybody here, but friends, we're all brothers and sisters. We're all kindred in Christ. Let us have patience in our works and hold it fast to the end. Let us not be concerned with those that lie, that those who try to overcome the church, those that try to destroy the church. Let us not be concerned with them. Let us not be concerned with how long we've been in the trial. Friends, I've never been tempted for 40 straight days like Christ was by Satan. But friends, if He has done it and given us an example, we can also endure likewise. If He has given us these blessings here in this earth to understand that this church is His, that He's given us an open door. Friends, the last open door that we have goes beyond the walls of His worship service. It is when we leave this place, you know how we carry that open door with us? His door of prayer is open all the time. And He will always hear our prayers and our supplications. Because friends, Jesus Christ is our mediator that stands there between us and God. And He brings our request and makes them known unto His Father. So that door is open for us. No matter how bad the temptation may get, He's still coming. And in His sight, He's coming quickly. But friends, until that day that He comes, may we overcome. May we do righteously. May we walk circumspectly in this world. May we stick with Him no matter what comes. And friends, may we, when we come to the house of the Lord, find His presence with us in a way that the world will never know. And find the very portal of heaven made accessible to us as we experience His rich presence here.
This is a church doing well. Friends, I want us as a church to do well likewise. If these things have been a blessing, if you've been encouraged, you give God all the praise, honor, and glory. May the Lord bless you, is my prayer.